very much, Mike. We can hand over now to Caroline Saunders. Are you there, Caroline?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you very much. And I think if we go into the first slide, which ironically is titled Conclusion. So we'll start there and end there. So thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to sort of look a little bit about the economic impacts and pick up some of the issues that Steve and Mike have introduced. Steve and Mike have outlined the global issues really well, and I think we should remember that New Zealand has leading edge science here, and we can certainly help the world address many of these global issues, and it's important we maintain our leadership in this area and in the pastoral research. This, what I'm hoping to do over the next 5 minutes or so, is just have a look away up the consumer attitude. And picking up on Mike's point, it's, as we say, that there's a difference between actual and perceived, and we're watching very carefully how consumers' attitudes are developing around the world and how they make impact on us and how these are changing. The risk to New Zealand is that generally the high-value premium markets tend to be, at the moment, focused against GM product. But the new developments in GM product that Mike's been outlining to you, which enhances the attributes of products that consumers can see, so that's helping deal with issues such as climate change, helping issues that are very up there in the consumer's mind, such as drought, generally are much more acceptable and increasing in acceptance. We have to be careful, though, that just enhancing production can have a negative impact, given that it may reduce our premium market, so the price we get for our product, and also we may have to discount our product selling out there. New Zealand can't feed the world. We're only a tiny part of the world production supply, about 2% for dairy. But where New Zealand can really help the world is perhaps through looking at these technologies and this leading-edge science. Next slide, please. If we look at some of the results coming out, it's mixed. As both Steve and Mike have suggested, that the Asian markets are less resistant to GM technology. But in the EU, you're seeing mixed results with some resistance to GM growing, and again, our concern is this is the high-value end of the market. As Steve has suggested, it's difficult to get results knowing how people have an attitude to animals fed with GM forage. Some studies from the US show that there's a little discounting going on there where the product's been fed with GM corn. Next slide, please. A recent study in Europe has shown that if GM made the food healthier, then people would be willing to pay for this. And if it's got environmental attributes, such as the one Mike were outlining, such as climate change, drought resistance, again, that you're seeing much more preference towards that. Interestingly, the less desirable GM traits, they're not very interested if it's approved, and also price isn't a big issue with GM. Next slide, please. The next slide shows research from New Zealand, and the next two slides do, and again, picking up Steve's point, we have to be cognizant of attitudes within New Zealand and how they are developing. And here, a number of attributes were looked at. Butter with less cholesterol, milk from cows fed with GM clover, meat from double muscle sheep, antioxidant apples, and bread from efficient wheat and insect-resistant sweet corn. But rejection tended to be reasonably high, around 40%. Indifference was quite high as well. But some consumers were also willing to pay a premium for this product. Next slide, please. This slide shows those results put on a distributional, which may look a bit strange at first, But I think the main message to get across from this slide is if we look at the bar of coming up from zero from the horizontal axis, it shows that the biggest feel from the New Zealand consumers was to the left and asking for a discount if this kind of product came to the market. Next slide, please. In this slide, we're looking at some modelling work we did looking at the introduction of product into the world, and this is with an international trade model, looking at the impact under a number of scenarios. And here we're assuming New Zealand's 50% GM, and we have a 20% productivity increase. And then various scenarios, would the consumers want a discount, or would they offer a premium for this product? And I think this raises an important issue, that if New Zealand only has this technology, we tend to benefit more. But if this technology is available to all countries, as the right-hand column shows, that we tend to lose. But what this slide is ignoring, and an issue that has yet to be addressed really by economists and others, is the benefits to New Zealand of world-leading science and the IP associated with this. And they may be well exploring, looking at the IP that Mike and the others are generating with their research on drought-resistant varieties or climate change varieties, and how that is in great demand in other areas of the world. Next slide, please. So just some general comments before coming back to the conclusion slide. Increasing productivity generally doesn't increase farmers' incomes. This has to go alongside some kind of attribute that helps enhance the product for the consumer. This is because demand for agricultural products tends to be in what we call inelastic, so that if you get more, people actually pay less. The structure of world trade for New Zealand tends to compound the effects because we have trade barriers into our key premium markets, and so that our increased production goes to low-value markets, and that we also have an impact on world prices. Final slide, please. Now, coming back to the conclusion again, the cautionary we have to watch and be careful, as Mike says, over the next 10 years, is how in particular our high-value premium markets' attitudes to GM change, particularly as these new generation GM products come onto production that have these enhancing products. As the next point says, that it's more acceptable if we've got GM technology that offers consumers some benefits and we market that well. And finally, that I think we need to explore further the benefits from the IP. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Caroline. I'm now going to unmute all the participants in the conference. I think to start out questioning, we did get actually an email with some questions before the briefing began, so I will hand over to Kent Atkinson from the NZPA for, if you'd like to choose one of those questions, Kent, and then we'll continue from there.
I was interested in the label Cisgenic and the extent to which the promotion of it since an article in Nature, I think about 2006, is actually part of a effort by the biotech sector to render genetically engineered plants and animals more palatable to consumers by differentiating them from transgenic GE organisms, such as, for instance, potatoes containing genetic material copied from toads.
Perhaps Mike?
I think that the real issue in relation to development of gene technology is that we've become much more sophisticated and as we've learned more, and some of the technologies that we can use now can achieve the same results with methods that are much less intrusive and much more targeted. So for pastoral genomics, we're using cisgenics because we think we can achieve the same results without a bigger genetic distance between the material that's being being moved around in the plant. And the particular reason that we think it's important for New Zealand is because of the whakapapa and the Maori issue, the life force issue that's specific to New Zealand. We don't see it as a way of getting around the regulations, but as a way of meeting the particular cultural significance of the indigenous people of New Zealand.
But surely Jack Heineman, when he wrote a recent piece in Cyblogs, put his finger on it when he suggested that there's no minimum size on the material that the people doing cisgenic work can move around, and there is scope for no minimum string length, if you like, for manipulation. So there is scope for them to create strings that are just as foreign to that genome as anything that came from a different species. You could have a gene from a human could be rearranged, become 70% different to its original form, which would really be just as different as the average gene in a human is to the average gene in a single-celled soil microorganism. I think he suggested that cisgenic or intragenic construct looks and quacks like a transgenic duck.
It's Stephen here. Look, we included this issue in the paper that the Royal Society put out precisely to stimulate debate on this issue. And I think it's good that the cisgenic transgenic debate has been aired further through the paper, which is one of the intentions of the paper. I think what's going on now is what we feel is a useful derivative of the Royal Society's effort.
Is there any comment on the fact that somebody using cisgenic technology can, or cisgenic approach, can actually create something that is just as foreign to the original organism as a transgenic import?
Well, my view is, and always has been, is that you need to evaluate the traits, not the process.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Thank you.
Can we, I'll hand it to Philippa Jameson. She's put her hand up in the chat box with the question. If we could have a question from you.
Hi, yes. Philippa Jameson, Organic NZ magazine. This is a question for Mike. I'm just wondering if any of the pastoral genomics or ag research projects are happening on either organic farms or biologically managed farms that you know do not use synthetic fertilisers.
None of the projects that I talked about have been outside the laboratory yet.
Right. Okay. So the pictures of those grasses.
Yep.
Is that indoors?
That's in the Biotron at Lincoln University under PC2 containment.
Right. So it's in some kind of glass house.
No, it's in a growth chamber.
Right. But I'm just wondering about the soil because when studying drought tolerance of these grasses. I'm just wondering about how holistic the studies are. I'm just wondering if you're taking into account the quality and the structure of the soils that the grasses are being grown in, because you know, there've been a lot of studies done and on organic, organically managed farms, and the soil structure is generally better and has better water holding capacity and so on. And so I'm wondering, you know, how valuable is it to study the drought tolerance of grasses in isolation, or you know how, you know, if you've got a holistic picture with you know the soil qualities taken into account, that's part of the whole ecosystem.
Well, that's one of the things that we can really only study effectively when we get into the field.
Yeah.
because all the issues that relate to growing pastures in the field in relation to the tolerance to grazing, the tolerance to insect pests, diseases, all those issues we really can't test until we go into the field.
So are you doing other research projects that are looking at the drought tolerance of grasses grown in organically managed and biologically managed situations?
Are you asking me as chair of the Board of Pastoral Genomics? We are not,
yeah.
As Pastoral right. Genomics, because we have a very narrow focus.
It's Stephen here. Look, AgResearch is becoming obviously increasingly interested in that subject as the threat of drought is showing up. So that's part of AgResearch's focus on sustainability.
Right.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Can I open the floor up to another question?
It's Carla here from Radio New Zealand. I'm just wondering if Stephen can answer this. I'm wondering, to clarify, when are we looking at opening up this, replying to IRMA for a conditional release of the GM grass for experimental purposes? When are we going to do that field research?
Look, I can't answer that. As I say, we didn't really cover that off through the Royal Society particularly, and I'm not really able to comment on that. I don't know if Mike can.
Well, there's more information that we need to get before we can contemplate going to IRMA. We need comprehensive information because our standards are as high as anywhere in the world for testing for these things. And what we are likely to... We currently are doing some evaluations, field evaluations in the US, and it's probable that we will test the drought-tolerant lines in eastern Australia. And the reason for that is that we can be sure, we can be much more sure of getting a good reading for drought tolerance in Australia than we can here, because even in the Hawke's Bay or in Canterbury, we might get 100 mils of rain in the middle of November, and that's the end of the field experiment evaluation for that year.
So is the drought stuff the grass, the varieties that you're likely to apply for outdoor field trials first, or is there any others that might be ready before that?
No, that's likely to be the first one. I mean, we're still at strategic research stage, and it's difficult to make firm comments as to when particular things will happen because we're still finding out information.
Perhaps you could tell us whether Pastoral Genomics is primarily interested in the clover genome or the ryegrass, or both?
Oh, we're working with both.
Right.
Sandra Taylor from Country Road. Mike, are you looking at other pasture species such as lucerne, such as those drought-tolerant plants, and looking to use transgenic methods to transfer genes from those into ryegrass, or are you just concentrating on cisgenic ryegrass?
We're concentrating on ryegrass and clover, but what we learn in one legume or in one grass makes it much easier to understanding the issues with other species in the same genera, in the same family. The more fundamental the knowledge is, the more widely it is able to be used, and that's the whole, the human genome is advancing animal genome studies.
Right.
Another question?
Can I ask, it's Ken Atkinson here, what scope is there for New Zealand and or Australian plant breeders to insert some kind of unique marker in these cisgenic plants and disclose that to regulators overseas so it's easier for authorities to provide for border protection and biosecurity and track genetically engineered seeds and other products even where they're not actually transgenic? And downstream from that, is there any likelihood that major retail chains might require such identification of seed for pasture plants that they can tell their consumers whether they're eating meat or milk that was grown on genetically engineered pastures?
You're looking a long way into the crystal ball there, Kent. Theoretically, I think the answer is that it's feasible. Practically, the more traits you are trying to deal with, the more difficult it is, and you know, I just, being an old conservative, I don't know that I would see that as one of the things that we should be spending a lot of time and effort on.
Following up from that, Philippa Jamieson again. In the latest issue of Organic NZ, we reported quotes from a couple of UK supermarket chains, Marks and Spencers and Sainsbury's, and they say that they will basically shun any products from animals fed on GE grass, and that, you know, they don't allow the use of GE crops, ingredients, additives or derivatives in their, Sainsbury's doesn't, in their own brand. Food, drink, pet food, dietary supplements and floral products. So, you know, at least those two supermarkets, and I think there's another major chain in the UK, have come out fairly strongly against that, that they see that it's, you know, a consumer advantage to be GE-free. So you may face some consumer resistance there. Any comment on that, perhaps, Stephen Goldson, in light of your comments about, I think you were talking about the markets.
Consumer resistance.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my comments were kind of the aggregate of what I'd heard. I have no particular personal knowledge. I think I understand that the kind of changing attitudes are patchy. Caroline talked about it more authoritatively than me, I think. Did you, Caroline?
Oh, I don't know if I talked about it more authoritatively. No, I mean,
you,
I would agree that if you look at the markets at the moment, they're definitely, and particularly the big supermarket chains in the UK, they're definitely don't want GM product. And I think the risk to New Zealand is that we don't want, certainly at the moment, to and over the next few years, to have any scare, in a sense. I think probably it's a way away than wanting, they'll actually trace it, but random testing, and if they found GM in our feed or in our product, that could have serious risks for our market access.
Caroline, can I make a comment about one of your comments, please? It's Stephen here.
Oh, go for it.
No, just this business about increasing production. There is an argument which I personally concur with, that it may not be the goal to increase production, but increase the performance so that you can actually stress the ecosystem less by having better performing forages. So you aim to maintain production,
yeah,
but take pressure off the landscape, which I think is one of the things I picked up during us putting this report together, that emerging as one of the issues.
And I would agree entirely, Steve, and that's what I was trying to say, because that is environmentally enhancing.
Yeah.
I think sometimes in the past, in that we have a rhetoric that maybe I've misread, is that, oh, we should be getting more out of, and I think we should be getting more value for our product, but not the technology that's sometimes being pushed, which I appreciate you're not doing here, that we should be getting more output, doesn't necessarily benefit us.
It doesn't necessarily benefit the ecosystem.
Definitely doesn't benefit the ecosystem, but doesn't benefit us economically either.
Yeah. If I wasn't clear, Caroline and others, maybe I was talking about productivity, not production.
Mm. Yeah, no, so... And I apologise, this is not, I appreciate, within this debate, but I think it's to be clear that the GM technology that's being pushed has to have some environmental ecosystem advantage as well as consumer advantage.
Is there any perceived need to change the legislation or the regulations in New Zealand so that non-transgenic GE organisms are given more favourable treatment by IRMA and MAF at the border and containment than transgenic GE plants and animals?
It's Stephen here, Ken. We didn't go there with our report, so that's not contained in the thing we produced. I don't know if my colleagues have anything to add. No, it's, we stayed out of that.
Can I ask, are there any questions from any of our journalists who have not had an opportunity to ask yet? All right. Then we may have time for one more question if someone who's there.
If nobody else has one, I did have one small question, a technical one. What gains can pasture plant breeders make with non-transgenic genetic engineering, such as GenX, that can't be made with marker-assisted selective breeding based on the extensive work that's already been done on the clover and ryegrass genomes and mapping of SNCs and QTLs and so on?
We're spending about as much resource on marker-assisted selection as we are on the gene technology stuff. And conventional breeding has historically delivered at about 1% gain a year compounding. We are making progress with marker-assisted selection, but it seems to us from where we've got to so far that we're making much greater progress with the cisgenic approach. Does that answer the question?
Well, yes, it's, I was interested whether there are any specifics, but that does address the issue. Thank you.
I'm not aware, for example, that we've been able to make any improvement on nitrogen use efficiency in grasses by conventional breeding. We seem to be making significant potential gains with cisgenic approach.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to thank our participants. Thanks to all the journalists for dialing in, and thank you very much to our panelists for some very interesting talks. I'd like to remind you that you can access the slides if you want to reference them in our resource library. You can also download a copy of the paper that this briefing is based on, the Royal Society Emerging Issues paper. It's there in the resource library, and that embargo is now up. And if you want to get in contact with any of our panelists, please get in touch with the SMC. We have all their details for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.